Hi, this is Paul. And even though I'm still in puppy prison, you can tell from my background, and there'll be interruptions for me. There's an event coming up in Arkansas. You can find the links in my channel. They've been there for a while. And these three fine gentlemen are going to be leading that event. Since we noticed that two of the three had titles, I decided to put my title in here. And but Ted, the guy without a title, is actually running the show, so he's gonna give a little introduction into what this. My dog's making noise. Into what this event is about, and then we'll take it from there.
Paul, you promise and deliver on the distractions. It's amazing.
Yeah,
Just
they're
like that.
here.
So this came out of me having an absolutely wonderful time at the Chino Conference in California, and that was just a delight, and realizing how much fun it was to be around all the people who have been, let's say, working through all the stuff, following these things, talking to each other. And at one point, I was sitting between Father Eric and Dr. Jim in the audience, and the amount of whispering that was going on back and forth, I was like, man, I just feel like these guys just win. They need to. I love what they have to say. I want to get them up there in front of people, and particularly what ended up being having a lot to do with this was Father Eric kept bringing up the Psalms, and Dr. Jim kept bringing up T.S. Eliot, and it occurred to me that there's this intersection with everything that people have been talking about and poetry is a very an enormously broad thing, you know, right? It ranges from what Father prays in the daily office to, you know, to the divine, like the Divine Comedy that me and Nate Heil and Sherry have been talking about on Grail Country to, you know, T.S. Eliot's modernist poetry. But behind all of that, I really think that poetry has a lot of, let's say, answers to what people are struggling with in terms of the situation where we're leaving modernity. We're trying to wrestle with these, let's say, new ways of looking at the world, these new frames that are not, like, say, strictly materialist. And I think that the poetic impulse, at least for the last while, has been is a big part of sort of restoring that. So that was the impetus behind it. I also know that a lot of the people in this little corner love poetry, and so they want to, like, we had a campfire time where people were just reading and reciting their favorite poems in Chino, which was an absolute blast. And I thought, man, I think a lot of these people would enjoy, let's say, more of an opportunity to share in this. So this isn't like, the idea behind this is not at all to, let's say, do a formal dive into, like, this is how you write poetry or doing poetry analysis, but really looking at how has poetry been a part of our pursuit of what's true and good on a much more personal level. And so and so Dr. Jim and Father Eric were, you know, first on my list in terms of thinking about that, just because I know how important it's been. So yeah, that's the impetus behind it.
So I'll jump in here. I came onto your channel, Paul, with kind of the thinky talky domain there, and really was kind of in the desert of having available venues to have conversation of that type. But and I think I expressed this and have expressed this a few times before, but my origin is really more poetic than it is, kind of thinky talky. And it does seem to me, it's been this way for a lot of my life. And also, I think it's maybe culturally true that kind of the mode of poetic discourse, the mode of poetry as a way of expressing oneself and experiencing, meaningful connection to our commonality, our common humanity, is kind of in a lower tier in some ways. We kind of gravitate towards the thinky talky. We, I think we could blame the Protestants for that. Who knows? But in the background, kind of my love is that poetic mode, that kind of affective, emotional mode. It's as and then that's been my love in terms of literature. And in a certain way, Eliot kind of brings together the thinky talky and the poetic, and he definitely leans or lives, at least in his, obviously his poetic work, on the poetic side of this. And it's his, I think it's his mission, if you will, to kind of bring those two things together and allow for the kind of poetic voice to be the way in which we wrestle with the, you know, kind of ideas that we all gravitate towards when we do the thinky talky thing, and try to encapsulate that in a poetic voice. And what I mean by a poetic voice is, if we're thinking in Christian terms, I think the best word for that perhaps is a mode of worship, a mode of feeling it as real, rather than a mode of arguing it. And I would like to try to, I'm really happy about the conference. I'm really excited about it, because this is something I really crave, is to have more detailed conversations of this type and to bring the poetic forward. I would say in the background, your conversation on Dante, and then prior to that, my contribution, my dipping into the conversation between Jess and Sherry on Job, has been a little bit of a kind of a preamble of what I really like as a way of, you know, of experiencing this type of thing. And I'm hoping, and I'm excited for the conference to do that same thing. I hope that made sense.
Oh yeah. 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 That's great. I think Eliot is, well, there's a whole number of poets, you know, yeah, going all the way back to Job, right? This isn't some modern thing. I mean, this is poetic expression, you know, goes down to the very depths of human communication. And it's particularly that integration point. There's something about poetry as being a point of integration of the self, but also of different ways of thinking. And that's a lot of what people are looking for is how can I bring these disparate parts of my life, of thought, of experience together in a way that there's some sort of coherence, and yeah, operating that poetic mode. Father, yeah, I wanted to, and so I one of the reasons that I wanted to bring you in on this is because your life is actually deeply shaped by, let's say professionally shaped by poetry, right? Mm-hmm. Do you want to give, I mean, I don't know how much you want to like, start by talking about that. I think if I remember right, you know, you were actually starting to go through the Divine Office, and for anyone, maybe even explain what the Divine Office is and what that has in your life.
Well, when I was in high school, my favorite author was Isaac Asimov. I loved the Robot series. I loved the Foundation series. And I don't know if you can get to be more modern in the materialist sort of sense than Isaac Asimov, right? And so, you know, he wrote The Caves of Steel. And in The Caves of Steel, you know, the humanity is grown to billions and billions and billions. And in order for humanity to survive, they place everybody in these massive cities that are very vertical. That's all indoors, right? And he was just thinking out how to make it possible for people to live in that sort of a city. So that was the sort of, that's what captured me in high school. I'm about 17 years old, and I'm thinking about the priesthood. So I go on a discernment retreat at a nearby seminary. And the first thing that I do after I get my bags put down in the room there is they say, okay, we're going to the chapel and we're going to do evening prayer. And I'm like, what's evening prayer? I have no idea. And then they go and they hand me this book that's got five ribbons sticking out of it. And they're like, okay, you're going to have to flip all over this thing. We're going to be reciting the Psalms. We're going back and forth. Go. I was just completely lost. I had no idea what was going on. That was my introduction to the Divine Office, was just this confusion, because all of a sudden we're just sitting there reciting Psalms, right? So I go off to seminary. I start to learn how to do this properly. And it's something that you do every day without anybody telling you why. Is that you just are given a breviary The older guys will tell you what page you're supposed to be on. You get the sense of going left side, right side, reciting the Psalms back and forth again. And I remember me and another first-year seminarian, he was a little older than I am. He had already had his college degree. He was asking, why are we doing this? Like, why is it so important that we not only recite the Psalms, that we're actually chanting the Psalms at 7 o'clock in the morning? And I didn't really have a good answer then. And I didn't know why, but, you know, it would be a formation issue if you didn't show up and start reciting the Psalms. The idea behind all of this is that, at least what I'm coming to understand and have come to understand over the past decade or so, is that we don't have the language to speak to God yet, just naturally on our own. And the beautiful thing about our faith is that, you know, we believe all scripture is inspired by God and is useful for teaching and all sorts of other things. The Psalms give us the language whereby we can actually pray to God. It's the exact same thing as us doing baby talk with children, right? That we give our language over to the next generation. We teach them how to talk so that they can talk to us, so that we can have a proper relationship with the whole world, you know, first with our parents and then out into the whole world. And so I think what I'm hoping to do with my talk is to explore a lot of that, specifically through my experience of learning how to pray the Psalms. Because as Jacob will remind us, they're poetry, even though that gets missed in most English translations.
Wow. You know, that just lines up with something that, you know, kind of frames the ideas that I've been wanting to talk about and to introduce Elliot in a kind of a vein that's similar. You know, a little bit of a story here, but, you know, back in the Enlightenment, there was this kind of creation of the university and the split of the university into the departments and the ultimate segregation, essentially, of theology as a kind of separate department. And we kind of ended up with some other department. What are we going to call it? The humanities, classics, ultimately, when it comes to the 19th century, it's literature or classics. And Paul's talked a lot about the thread of the theological side of that conversation. You know, the theology room was closed and they were all talking amongst themselves and trying to deal with very important stuff. And they, of course, had the resource of their theological vocabulary and theological categories to have that conversation, and that conversation progressed and maybe culminated at least in the 20th century in the fundamentalist modernist debate and all that. But what's not talked about there is what was going on in the other room, the classics room or the literature room. And I grew up in that room. And you know, if you think about the 19th century in this respect, what I think was going on was that they were faced with the situation where the theological categories and the theological vocabulary no longer worked. And I don't like thinking of it as they banished it. They said, oh, go over there. You know, we don't want to deal with you anymore. I think it was more that the cultural environment, the zeitgeist, made it such that that vocabulary for them no longer had authority. It no longer worked. The problem with that, though, is that they had to go on talking. They had to go on doing stuff. They had to look at the classics. They had to read the Latin. They had to read they had to create new works. They had to do stuff and talk about the situation of us and everything and how we fit together with everything. And what I think a kind of a one version of us of that story is that, you know, you move from the Romantics to the late Romantics in the Victorian era, and you ended up with a kind of ennui, a kind of melancholy. And that melancholy was kind of a manifestation, if you will, of the loss of that language. It was a sense that that we have nostalgia for a world that never existed, and we don't know where to go. We don't know that there's anywhere else to go. And you get that in people like Tennyson, I think, and then that gets more profound when you get to someone like Matthew Arnold. And I think it is something that, and maybe even in a kind of wild-eyed way, you see it in Nietzsche. And Eliot comes in right after that, and he is really, I think he thinks that that is a real problem, and it has a theological basis, that problem, that is based in a kind of progressivism, a notion of progressivism. And that's not necessarily the progressivism of, you know, we're going to make new things and do great things in the world. It's the progressivism at a kind of foundational level that we've moved on from the past. That is to say that we're disconnected from the past. We can't think of the past as part of who we are. And I think Eliot thought that was an impossible way of thinking about what humanity is. And he struggled. He was young. He has a very interesting over and a whole history, but I think he struggled with that. And I think he ultimately found for him that the solution was, Ted's going to like this answer. The solution was Dante. And you have to, and what he basically was going to say is something like, you know, look, the withdrawal of faith is not new. The withdrawal of faith is something that's always been present. And you can see how Dante struggles with the withdrawal of faith, I think. And the way he contextualizes it is that he puts those who face the withdrawal of faith in the inferno. Yeah. That is to say, he contextualizes them there and then frames the huge journey. And then they sit there. And you can either be someone whose destination is the inferno, or you can be a traveler. You can be a pilgrim, and those are your two choices. And then Eliot, I think, wanted to take that notion and kind of embed it in his poetic project. And that's a complicated idea. And I in a couple of talks at this conference, I hope to be able to flesh that out and show that. That at least one way of viewing the later works is that he's kind of trying to mirror the project of Dante, and that's my idea there in terms of Eliot.
Jim, you just dropped like 7 depth charges in my brain. Oh my goodness.
I'd love to hear the way you think Gerard Manley Hopkins fits into that, because he's just a couple generations right before Eliot, and he's dealing with the same stuff, I'm sure.
Yes. Oh yeah, Paul.
I'm curious. I'm intrigued by what both of you said, and it gets into both the rise of science, because I think Jim, you framed it very well that. You know, at the end of the 19th century, theology was the queen of the sciences, because in the modern period, I have an airport nearby, so that's the problem with outside. In the modern period, everything had to be a science, and so you had this attempt to turn theology into a science. And one of the interesting things about that is that poetry, there were various little attempts to sort of try to domesticate poetry with science, and I think they all failed. It was just a wrong categorization. And now that, you know, I think Verveke might call poetry a psychotechnology, and I think Eric was talking about that in terms of it's a different register for human beings than narrative, than theory. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts both on poetry as psychotechnology, and also poetry as a domain that can't sort of be it can't be colonized and domesticated by science.
A lot there. Father Eric, I think you were going to jump in with something. If not,
I was. Yeah. So what we're also dealing with there with theology as a science is the change in the definition of the word science.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Because for the Greeks, a science was any kind of disciplined field of knowledge that proceeded from first principles. So Thomas Aquinas talks about theology being the queen of the sciences, but he had a much broader notion of what science was. What we would now casually refer to as science, he would have called natural philosophy, which I think is better framing, but that's okay. So that was just my little, one of my little soapboxes I have to get on and shout at people for.
But Father, that actually ties in really well with a lot of the things that we're I mean, because if you just listening to the people that we're talking about, these poets all the way back, right? One of the things that poetry does is unless you try really hard, it immediately connects you way back. I mean, everyone's going up to the stream, right? I mean, this is like Eliot. You realize that one of the main keys to reading an American immigrant to England in the early 20th century is a man who lived in Florence in the Middle Ages, 600 years before him. It's like, and Dante in some sense is more real to Eliot than most of like the modern situation for Eliot at that time. So there's this immediate, I mean, so then you start dealing with, you start waking, one of the things it does when you, and Lewis made this point over and over and over about read old things, is that you start to come to terms with these notions of what does the word science mean? Has it always meant that? What did it used to mean? You know, what's happened to us? And Owen Barfield wrote an entire book on this, Poetic Diction, which is all about that process. And he has a particular theory of it, but it's interesting if you can get through it. It's kind of crazy to read, but I wanted to hone in on this particular thing. And I think this actually strikes at a lot of what we're trying to get at. So it was funny, Dr. Jim, you were saying that you see Dante as sort of Eliot's point of integration, like how he's solving this problem. And it strikes me that, you know, here we are another 90 years later, and you've got someone like Rod Dreher writing How Dante Can Save Your Life. Yeah. Right? There's this. Okay, so then you've got that. And then the other thing that I thought of was the Jonathan Peugeot and Richard Rowland conversation about reading medieval works. And they reference that there's a lot of connection between that and the discarded image, right? And then even you've got Karen, and I haven't listened to this conversation, but I want to, with Schindler and Ian McGillicrest, where they, you know, it's about the discard, reinstating the discarded image. But central to that, what Lewis chooses as his main way of describing what it was like to be a medieval is to present Dante. He says, here's the Divine Comedy. If you wanted to understand what it was like, the best that we can do to understand what it was like to live as a medieval is to see the Divine Comedy. And so there's this thing where again, it gives you this capacity to walk into something that you wouldn't be able to if you're just, say, reading a textbook about the economic or political or technological situation of that world. It's like that lets you see some things that a modern person would see about that time. But if you want to have, let's say, a temporal bandwidth that's wider than 20 years or 60 years or 5 years or 10 minutes, it's like poetry is the capacity that elevates you to get from just looking more broadly at, say, the kinds of things we are important now, to being able to actually see. It's a step up. It's like, what did Dante think was important? Not what did Dante fill the universe with, but what was the structure of his universe, right? I think it really, it moves you up a couple of levels when you start engaging with it at that level. Oh, there's the puppy. Look at that dog.
Father Eric, you want to throw in, or I can always jump in. So I'm trying to resist.
Yeah. No, I don't. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the way what Eliot is saying, and what I think one of the ways of framing what Eliot is saying, is that this idea of living in a world disconnected from the past is itself a way of being connected to the past. That is to say, it's one mode of being, kind of in the whole stream, and that it's an illusion in the end, and it's a part of it's a bad choice, let's say. It's a bad choice. And we need to make the other choice. We need to choose to integrate ourselves into that large sweep. And I think that, you know, you can see this in obviously the Divine Comedy, in that, you know, it's not that this is just a Christian narrative. I mean, obviously he's pulling in everything that occurred prior to him, and he's taking it all in there. He's patching it together, like a, you know, like a painting of Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel, or a version of Peugeot and Rollins' Universal History.
Yes, yes, you know, thank you.
And what Eliot is kind of trying to say is, hey, look, this we're inevitably going to do this. We inevitably tell a universal history story. And because we inevitably do that, we should do it intentionally. We should do it with full engagement with that stream that we are inevitably in. And to pretend like we're not in it is just a bad way of dealing with that situation.
Right, because otherwise it's your 11th birthday and you're waiting for your Hogwarts letter to show up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's real. That's real right there. And this makes me think about some of the conversations I've been having with Mark Lefebvre of Navigating Patterns fame. And one of his major themes is that materialism leads you to denial of creation. And what he means when he's talking about denial of creation is that there was something that came before you that you are beholden to. You know, talking about all of this, the great poets, you can't really read Dante without knowing a thing or two about Virgil, right? Because, boy, it turns out that guy's important too. And it's like, like all of this is just going to take us back to the Bible and to Homer. And
yeah, there you go.
About exactly. As far that's back as we can make point. It, at least in the West. That's something that I appreciate.
That's why I think Dreher is right. I mean, if you had only two books to introduce people to in high school, hopefully, but maybe in college, it would be the Bible and the Divine Comedy. And if you did those two books, you'd have a start in essence to what you need there.
And so that's why I appreciate my own formation and my own tradition, because I'm not naturally inclined to read poetry. I'm naturally inclined to read Isaac Asimov, right? That's not where my home base is. He's not a very poetic fellow at all. And he's not very rooted in the past. So that's where my home base is. But, you know, whether I like it or not, I'm going to show up at 7 a.m. and chant the Psalms until they get into me. And so that's actually, you know, transformed the way I look at the world. Well, now I look at Isaac Asimov and he's just like, okay, you've got two out of the four causes here and that's it. Material cause and efficient cause. You don't have formal or final. And now it's, you know, it's not like I think it's bad or I regret reading it, but it's like, that's not my home base anymore. So,
hey, Ted, give us a hint as to what you're going to give us in Arkansas.
You bet. Sorry, there's a train going by. I have a train tracks right nearby. So we've got planes, trains. Can someone give us automobiles in the background? Yeah, so it's really interesting. And this actually connects with several things. So first off, Father Eric, I love hearing this about you, because in high school, I was on the sci-fi train. Like, if it's a book about like super detailed descriptions of terraforming Mars, I'm there. I will spend hours there. You know, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, the older guys too.
Because that's the only possibility for enchantment in a materialist frame.
Oh, I remember that. I mean, like, I know that, like, the descriptions of seeing a dead planet come to life, like, that's creation. Like, that's a creation account. And you just drink it up. You're like, because if you can't appreciate things, and then all of a sudden you're reading this story about a desert world and someone goes outside and for the first time there's a plant growing there. You know, it's, oh my goodness, plants are a miracle. It's like, yes, of course they are. Right. Which I have another thesis, which is that science fiction is actually a subset of fairy stories. But we can talk about that another time. So When I was in college, I finally started reading poetry, and there's some poetry that I really liked. Dante grabbed me. So I would say that you could probably write a book, just like you could write a book, how Dante saved my life. You could also write how Dante wrecked your life. And like, I lay a lot of my conversion to Catholicism at his feet.
It's understandable.
Because Lewis says about, so there's a whole bunch of funny connections here. Lewis says about George MacDonald that when he was this agnostic youth, that his imagination was baptized long before he converted when he read Fantastes. And I would say that my imagination might have been confirmed into the Catholic faith when I read Dante long before I had any notion of it. But let's see, this would have been after my third year of college. I went to England, to the English Labrie. If anyone knows what Labrie is, then... And so with the idea I was going to spend a bunch of time reading The Divine Comedy and and Paradise Lost. It was wonderful. One of the workers there, though, introduced me to Gerard Manley Hopkins. And that was groundbreaking. Hopkins was groundbreaking. And I couldn't figure out what it was that was going on there that was so powerful to me until I actually went to a different Labrie branch. Labrie comes into my story a lot in sort of that very early adulthood period. And one of the people there gave me a recording of a lecture that she had done, where there's a university professor down in Texas. I've actually spoken with her, Dr. Waterman Ward. She's a wonderful woman. There's a chance she's going to come to the conference, actually. And she wrote a book called The Philosophical Theology of Gerard Manley Hopkins, which, to your point about all of this, about the integration of humanities and theology and science and all this, the philosophical theology of Gerard Manley Hopkins is primarily demonstrated in his poetry. So there you go. You got it all together right there. But he has a couple of notions. And he spent a lot of time with St. John Henry Newman. And one of the things that they were working together on was basically the sort of linguistic materialistic reductionism that was going on in the universities at that time, which essentially said that, I mean, the very basic argument was something like, I'm gonna remember the word for it. But when you say a cat is a lion is a cat, you either mean the same thing, either a lion and a cat are the same thing, in which case you've said nothing, or a lion and a cat are not the same thing, in which case your statement is false. There's this sort of horrible reductionist positivism that connects with another problem, which is if you have a different idea of cat when you say cat than I do, how are we even communicating? And so Newman and Hopkins were working on this. When you read what these people are saying, it's like, oh, this is sort of late postmodernism, where we're siloing off into these kind of independent reference frames and seeing everything as abstract narratives that we construct and have no real relation to reality. So Newman has a more technical solution to this that I haven't spent a lot of time with. Hopkins works out in his poetry with two concepts that he calls the inscape and instress. And, you know, they work for some people and they don't work for some people, but they just totally lit a fire in my brain when I came across these. It's his understanding of how the intellect approaches reality and how the will responds to it. And it's very cohesive. And I think it does a really good job with how we view poetry and how we walk ourselves out of this. Well, okay, to bring up Mark Lefebvre again, because I also spend a lot of time talking with Mark. You've got this one-to-one correspondence notion that people generally think the more true things are, the more I'm in this one-to-one correspondence. Poetry just breaks that, because the whole thing is about many to many, right? What is Beatrice, right? Who is Beatrice? Like, you just think about that and you'll start to get what's going on there. And so something like the volumes that you could write about who and what Beatrice is her inscape. You're approaching the internal scape, which is, it's a point of integration of your personal relation to things, your sense perception, your intellection, your associations, all of this. It's all this thing that you're coming to. So that's a little taste of what I think Hopkins has got. And then bringing that out in his poetry, because that's what his poetry does, is it makes you walk through those inscapes. It's wonderful.
That's interesting, because of course, biblical poetry is all about these parallelisms.
Yes.
It's always sort of setting these things next to each other. And sometimes they're opposites, but they're like opposites. They're always set next to each other. And there's a sense in which, you know, these relations just force you to go deeper into, let's say, the relational combinatorial explosiveness of, you know, it's the problem of category. And how many ways are these, is the lion and the cat? How many ways do we set these things next to each other? And the truth is, with almost all of these things, they can go, naughty dog, they can go in so many different directions. And so that's a fascinating thing. Now, so there's theory, of course, which is the thinky-talkie, and there's poetry. Where do you guys see, I mean, because there is very much in this little corner, there very much is a poetry cadre that I think will be attracted to this. Talk a little bit about, let's say, maybe the fall and rise of poetry and why you think we're at this moment now where, you know, Rod Dreher will talk about Dante and, you know, Dante save your life. Why now, particularly, let's say, I think at the, I mean, and it was really, you know, it was really Jim who clued me onto this with Sam Harris that, oh yeah, people are feeling the tide going out on modernity, which means that just like when the tide came in, these tools that everyone was using sort of, you know, go offline. Now that modernity's tools are kind of going offline, why now the rise of poetry? And then how does this conversation fit in?
Dr. Jim, you want to start on that?
Well, I would answer in a personal way, because, you know, for me, because I don't know that I have a great answer for how that would play itself out. It is a question of what the venue for poetry is. I mean, is there a good venue for poetry? And hopefully maybe this Arkansas thing will be a little bit of a venue where it's highlighted and put up on the stage or allows us to do that more intentionally. Personally, it's this thing I've been talking about. You know, the thinky-talky stuff is coming from an experience of the world. You know, when I first read about and studied philosophy and, you know, introducing the rationalist empiricist debate and all that stuff, and we got to Hume, I was horrified. That is to say, the right response to Hume, and I don't mean that I'm criticizing him, I mean that vision of the world, which is compelling. It's not that it's not compelling, it is compelling, is horrifying. And that's at the base of that. That's what's underneath the ideas, if you will. And so, so for me, poetry is, if you will, the vehicle, or one vehicle. I think religiosity and worship, but maybe other things in life, music and other ways of experiencing community are other vehicles for this. But poetry for me is a way of recognizing and then embodying, incarnating, let's say, the effective relationship we have with our experience. And so it's not like we're trying to solve a problem, and there's lines in Eliot for everything, and there's a line in Eliot for this. It's not like we're trying to solve a problem here. We're trying to position ourselves correctly with the way the world really is, and end up expressing that in community, expressing that with real felt emotion. And for me, poetry does that. I do think that the venue in which you do that is difficult to create. It's difficult to create. So that's the problem for me. But anyway, I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Yeah.
So responding to your question, Paul, let's take Grim Grizz seriously with his idea of Set as a false god that's taking over. Him being a false god, he cannot create. He can only consume. And that the intention devouring monster, which has been growing and growing and growing since the advent of the printing press is now getting to the point where it's almost entirely consuming humanity. And you can experience that if you binge something on Netflix for more than about 2 hours, right? Mm. You get to that feeling at the end, that nausea and disgust with yourself, to realize that you've just been worshiping a demon with bad substitute religion. And then you hear the sound of water, or maybe even the promise of water in this barren wasteland that you've created for yourself. And you're drawn towards even perhaps just the sound of thunder.
Oh, I love it. Promises the water. You're jumping right all over Elliot there. I love that.
Mm. So it's like at a certain point, you hit rock bottom, and this is like an AA thing where you either have to go up or die. And poetry is one of those places you can go.
I like that. That's very good.
So
he was gesturing at lines from the wasteland, from Elliot's wasteland.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things, is that poetry is just so good at giving you a way to speak. It's just, it's like you're just being handed. Here's the best expressions. Yes. Of thousands of years of men and women. Here it is for you. You can have that. It's like, are you going to go out and build your own car? Of course not. Like, that's stupid. You've never been anywhere. So yeah, the notion of originalism, we could talk about that, but I would actually add something else to that, which is, so Paul, when you gave your opening talk at Chino, you went to who? You went to the modern poets, right? And who are the modern poets? They're musicians, right? And you,
Yeah.
And you quoted all these song lyrics. And so I would say poetry's never gone away. We just, to Dr. Jim's point, we've considered there to be this academic historical poetry thing, and we say that's poetry. And I would say, yeah, it is. But as Owen Barfield says, the mansion of poetry is a vast place, right? It is, because it is not an academic subject. And I would say that in its most basic definition, poetry is not even a form of writing. Poetry is not a form of writing. There is forms of writing that are more poetic than others, but poetry is not a kind of writing. Verse is not poetry. Much poetry is verse and much verse is poetry, but those are not overlapping spheres completely. So I would say that what we're doing is, I think what I think should happen, and probably what is going to happen, is something like what has gone on with the notion of narrative, where we've all woken up and realized, hey, this undergirds everything. And if it does, we should probably pay attention to it and try to do a good job with it. And so I think that's what's going on, is realizing, and that's my hope, is to bring forward that poetry is both always present in the human mind, because that's how we are, unless you're dead, and then there's no poetry. But poetry is going on on some level in you. And if it is, let's go ahead and try to be conscious of it and bring it forward in the best way possible. And also bring up all of the resources and goodness that's there, that's been given to us, right? This is, again, that notion of it's all the Bible and Homer, right? That immediately says none of this is a blank slate, just like you're not a blank slate. As much as you're thrown into your life, you're also thrown into the poetry of the world. And it's not like we're in some arbitrary multiverse where it could have been anything. It's like, maybe that's an unanswerable question. That's not where we are. Where we are is that these men and women walked in this world and spoke these things. And so disrealization, right? This whole notion that the incapacity to feel that reality around you is real. There's a connection there between the making the world not arbitrary. I mean, the world is not arbitrary. And one of the ways to come to that is the fact that there's poetry that's good and there's poetry that's bad, and we recognize it. And there are specific people who wrote these things. It's not some, you know, sort of the antithesis to, okay. So on one hand, you have people who are formed by on a religious level, the Psalms and Job. And then on the less explicitly religious level, but still totally tied up with all of that, these great poets. And then, you know, that's one. And then on the other side, you have Borges. And if you haven't ever read, if anyone has not read Jorge Luis Borges, he's a short story writer from South America. And I've never seen a better narrative encapsulation of what the postmodern intellectual project does. I highly recommend him to you. His short story collection, Labyrinths, when you read it, you'll recognize, first of all, it's influenced all sorts of people. You read it and you're like, oh, this is where some of the most striking images from Christopher Nolan's Interstellar came from. It's from the Library of Babel. And the notion of the Library of Babel, this doesn't spoil anything because he brings out some real profoundly horrifying things from it, is this universe that consists of these hexagonal library rooms that are all connected with pathways and spiral staircases. And every three of the walls all have bookshelves. They all have the same number of books. The books all have the same number of pages. The pages all have the same number of characters. And it's every single possible book that could be written, right? Every combination of those characters. That's the universe, okay? That's the universe that we've tried to present ourselves with this sort of removing the poetic, removing the created aspect of reality. And Borges holds it out and says, is this really what you want, basically? And so poetry is one of the ways to say, we don't look at the world and see random strings of characters. That's not what speech is. That's not what stories are. That's not what poetry is. There's actually a pattern that you can really come to know and be in relationship with. And so I think it's waking back up to that's always happening. Because if you don't do it, someone else will do it to you.
I like that, Ted. That was good. That was good.
So your conference, I won't be there, which is too bad. I can only go to so many things a year. But tell me, well, I have a sense listening to you guys talk about why, because I think we've already covered that. But tell me a little bit more about what you want to do here, what you want to accomplish with this.
Yeah, well, I'll say two things, you know, since I'm putting this together, it's structured around this, and, you know, Father Eric and Dr. Jim can come with what they want. And I think this aligns pretty well. So what one is, you know, I think I brought this up in the first conversation with Nate and Sherry about the Divine Comedy, that we're not, I think one of the problems with our, part of the reason that poetry has been relegated in people's minds to where it is because of the notion that to be interested in poetry is to study it. And I think that's completely the wrong answer. I think you need to love it. So this is a chance to love poetry and to be around people who do love poetry or who want to love it as well, because love is actually the right approach to poetry. So that's part of it. And then we're going to have some time where people can actually go up and recite or read poetry that they've written or poetry that they love. And so part of it, yes, we're going to talk together. We're going to sit together. We're going to talk. We're going to have conversation. We're going to have some, you know, in that way, it'll be structured kind of similar to Chino. But I would, really the spirit behind this is to give people a chance to participate in this a much deeper way. And so in as much as it's good to talk about poetry, it's even better to read it and to hear it. On the other hand, you can also just fill up and then you've got to do something, right? It's like walking through an art museum. It's like, whoa, after a little while, you're just full. Like you can't take in anymore. So we're going to try to strike the right balance there, but really to give, and so there's one category of people that I hope will be there, which is people that already understand this and want to be enriched and to have really good conversation. The other category is the set of people who say, are looking at this and think, I have no idea how to do this. It's, you know, I hear good things about poetry. There's people that I love that quote poetry, et cetera, but I just don't know what I'm doing. That feels way above my pay grade. And what I would like to have is a place for people to realize this is the project of every man and woman. You can do it. It's not about being able to answer test questions. It's about being able to actually come in contact, real contact with your intellect and with your will. So with your head and with your mind and your emotions, with reality through these beautiful words that have been given to us and that we also have the capacity to bring forth out of ourselves.
Yeah, I like that. In fact, as I struggle to think about how I'm going to, kind of present, I'm really working to try to put into it the reading, you know, readings of the poems mm-hmm. that I'm wanting to talk about. And, rather than it be purely didactic or expository. So that's going to be a struggle for me. But it's going to be part of the idea behind what I'm going to try to do.
Yeah.
Well, I like what you said about, I think one of the challenges right now is bringing to awareness the point you made, Ted, that poetry hasn't left us. It's taken on different forms. You know, the most the most poetic cast member of the Freddie and Paul show is Freddie, if you've ever watched the Freddie and Paul show. I mean, rap is ubiquitous in, you know, a lot of Black culture right now, and rap is poetry, and and they're fairly overt with that. I remember, I've told this story before. I remember getting a call. A former member of the church was in the hospital. He was dying, and you know, we tend to try to civilize death too. You know, you put people on morphine, just sedate them on their way out. Well, in this case, you know, this individual, he was, you know, it was a vile and ugly death. He was fighting it all the way. And his estranged wife was there and her brother, both of whom had been raised in the church. And it was such a poignant moment. We're sitting in this waiting room while, you know, this man is dying. And so you've got kids and ex-wives and, you know, all this, you know, there's just a lot of tension in the room just by virtue of the way he had lived his life and the relationships that were there. And just the most interesting thing happened because the ex-wife and her brother basically embraced in the middle of the hospital waiting room and began to sing Kenny Rogers the Gambler together. and I thought, good grief. It's not a hymn. It's not a psalm. It's Kenny Rogers the Gambler, which, you know, many people might sort of look down upon them and, you know, from our elite, highbrow, educated status and despair. But, you know, it proves your point about poetry. And I think, you know, for me, a big part of this mission that you three are clearly on with respect to this conference and probably quite further is part of what we're always trying to do, I think, in this little corner is sort of better our appetites to allow some of the more common forms to refine them and say, okay, if you liked Kenny Rogers, you might also like this. And I think about that with respect to this. And for me, who's not spent, you know, apart from, I mean, part of the things, I never preach out of the Psalms, very seldom unless I have to, partly just because I always had the sense of, I'm just going to take something that's beautiful and muck it up with all my other
words. Yeah.
And so, wow. You know, I think part of the cultural project that we ought to be about is to, you know, not just go with the well-educated, you know, high IQ people that that tend to like this kind of thing, but help all of us become aware of what's around us and maybe improve it.
Hmm. You know, Ted, when you were talking about music and even pop music as poetry, I was reminded of the fact that during the height of my materialist sickness in high school and early seminary days, the thing that actually brought me the greatest joy in my life wasn't the Psalms, but it was music that I was listening to. And I would engage with, we'll say somebody like Bruce Springsteen with, like I would actually get my old man's Born to Run CD and I would take the lyrics and I would memorize them because it had that kind of appeal to me. And I think that that was actually, you know, maybe it wasn't the best thing, but it was still a good thing because that gave me a satisfaction that the Sam Harris materialist nihilism that I saw as the alternative didn't let any room for that in.
Because
that was always the intellectual temptation was going there. And it always seemed like a black hole to me. So
that hunger is there, you know. Paul, I love that. I mean, I'm guessing that when you were talking about ordering appetites, you're probably pulling, you know, like me, I'm guessing that your first introduction to that was The Abolition of Man by Lewis. And, you know, that his whole point there is education and not as the transfer of information, but as the formation of people. And you form people by letting their intellect, which can approach truth, order their appetites through the emotions, right? Boy, we're talking about poetry now. And we're talking about poetry, and we're talking about stories, and we're talking about discipline. But we're talking, like, that is so much of what poetry can do for you. Is it moves you between those levels? Because if you don't, Set or some other demon will just chew you up and digest you, and you'll feel like a piece of spiritual trash floating around in some demon's digestive juices. Like, the whole project of ordering those appetites is really important. And just because it's important doesn't mean it's like ugly. It's definitely not ugly. It's beautiful. If you want to love beautiful things, like if you want to not run after the things that well, you know, this process of reciprocal narrowing that Verveke talks about, which I think is such a great notion. The only other thing besides reciprocal narrowing is ordering the appetites towards what is good and true and beautiful.
And just one more step along that way, when you're in that kind of infernal space of lostness, the way you describe it, one of the best ways out of that is to verbalize it, is to put it into words and look at it and recognize it. Mm-hmm. And I think back to Dante, this is what he is doing there is he's framing it. He's calling it real. He's showing you the experience of it, but also that in itself, in a way, making it an icon is, I don't know if that's the right way to frame it, but making it an icon, it makes it something that you, in a way, have a vehicle through which to move beyond it, let's say. And otherwise you're lost in it. Yeah.
You're lost in the dark woods. And that's I would point out that Dante, who is not the final cause, but the efficient cause of Dante's salvation, it's the ghost of a dead poet, right? Like, think about that. Is that what Virgil has? Virgil's who heaven sends. Virgil, yeah.
Yeah, and hopefully the barrier is not going to be to constantly mention Dante and then make this difficult barrier that people have to get over to kind of know this thing that we're talking about. You have to make it real now. And I hope that, you know, for me, Eliot was the vehicle mm-hmm. to that. And I hope we can talk in that way. As you said before, Dante was not someone in the past for Eliot. Dante was with him in the now. And, yeah. And hopefully we can, you know, do what some of the musical offerings of poetry do for people in ordinary life, some of which, frankly, is referring and referencing and using these same tropes. Mm-hmm. We can do that a little bit in the conference.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more from you, Jim, because you and I have talked before about, you know, Eric is a priest. I'm a pastor. I think in some ways the church has not always done a good job in feeding certain souls. And I think often certain souls that are perhaps better fed through poetry. So I'm curious, Jim, you made a few references to it early on, but I'd like to hear more from you in terms of, you know, we've talked about Westerns, we've talked about this, but often you've said, it's T.S. Eliot I really want to talk about. So, and tell me more about that in terms of You know, in terms of why, you know, why was it T.S. Eliot? And maybe this will give a little indication of, you don't want to have to give up everything that you're going to give at the conference, but flesh that out, and don't be afraid to be personal, because I mean, part of, I think, what has made this corner stick, you know, the truth is we've been at this 4 or 5 years now. Some of us who've been in early, I mean, part of what has made this stick is the personal. And I think, I think part of the power of poetry is its capacity to form and shape and move the personal. So, you know, Father Eric had the Psalms and being formed by the discipline of the priesthood. But what for you, Jim, was, you know, how did Eliot save your life? I'll phrase it that way.
Wow, that's hard, and it is in a way true. I mean, I think Eliot was in some sense a soul in pain, and he worked out that pain through his life and through his poetry, and ultimately through his conversion, and his becoming a Christian and living that out. But I didn't bump into Eliot as a Christian. I bumped into Eliot purely in this vein that I was talking about, this literary and a kind of to some degree academic stream that was kind of separate from the theological, or you know, but I obviously felt that wasteland that Father Eric was talking about. I was looking for that and I needed that hint of refreshing water somewhere. And when I read Eliot, it without any kind of theological or Christian understanding of what might be in Eliot that would be Christian, he is able to use words in a way that is just that in abstract, you take a short section and it doesn't necessarily need, particularly in the four quartets, you don't really need any of those references to recognize, you know, how that makes you feel. And so I grabbed onto that, and then it just stuck with me as I tried to work through it and try to internalize it and to understand it better. Kind of continued through my life. And of course, then it opened up, you know, why is he doing this? What is this reference? How am I going to get an even better or richer understanding of what he's doing? And that opened the ideas of the broader understanding of the history of the classics and literature. And then of course, Christianity. And that's how it happened for me. But it really goes to this sense that there was definitely some need that I had for a kind of refreshing water, and it was in there, and it was in there in a kind of honesty that reflected something about what I was experiencing. This is going to be one of my struggles, is actually to recite poetry, but I read something this. Here is a place of disaffection, time before and time after, in a dim light, neither daylight invested with lucid stillness, turning shadow into transient beauty with slow rotation suggesting permanence, nor darkness to purify the soul, emptying the sensual with deprivation, cleansing affection from the temporal, neither plenitude nor vacancy, only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces. Think the kind of empty space of a city full of people moving from one place to another, doing their daily lives. Only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces, distracted from distraction by distraction, filled with fancies and empty of meaning, tumid apathy with no concentration, min and bits of paper whirled by the cold wind that blows before and after time. That kind of a verse, it doesn't take anything to feel that. In fact, I was breaking up there at the end feeling that. And, you know, I didn't know anything other than wow, that's got something about me. That's something universal that is very close to who I am and what's happening to me. And it didn't take anything more than that to draw me in and lead me to try and understand it better and have a richer understanding. And that's where it is for me.
That's a good one, Jim. Man, I remember, I mean, here's what's amazing is that takes me right back to when I think I was 19 years old in college and I first read the Four Quartets. That is the Four Quartets, isn't it?
That's yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, I read them right together. But yep. Yeah, and just breaking me. And that, like, those distracted from distraction by distraction, like that, you know, how many times did I look up from my life and think, you know, men in bits of paper.
Yeah.
That's me. It's like empty of concentration. And there's this, yeah. Well, I love Nate Heil and I's first conversation. We're just talking, you know, sort of as a post-Chino thing. We ended up talking a lot about poetry, and he brought up poetry as witness, right? So poetry is fundamentally, poetry is about witness. And in that sense, poetry must also be about humility, right? Because how can you witness if you're not humble? And so I love all of that. And I think that was one of the things that meeting you at Chino and getting to talk. And that was one of it's wonderful too. Cause there's this other aspect too, where it's like, not only did Eliot see this thing and then articulate it in such a way that's so compelling to me, but then I meet Dr. Jim, who, you know, you've lived this whole life. We've had no interaction. And then we plop down in the same, you know, church in Chino, California. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I know that Jim's been seeing a lot of the same things I have.
Yep.
Because this thing has knitted us together independently and yet dependent, you know, together. So yeah, please. I intend to read a lot of poetry as I'm talking. I think bring all that to bear. You know, Lewis, what does Lewis say? He says something, he's quoting somebody. He's like, we do better with, you know, 90% of this guy's words and 10% of mine than the other way around. So, you know, I'm going to try to, I mean, I'm not even in the same room as you, Jim. And like, things changed as soon as you started reciting, yeah. Reading Eliot. It's like, yeah. Whoa, where did you take me? You took me somewhere.
Yeah.
We had our estuary meeting last night, and I'm just trying to think who was in the room of I've been so bad at scheduling this far in advance, but I kind of like it when we have a smaller group. So we only had about a dozen people there, and they're all hardcore estuary folks. Of the dozen of us in the room, I hope I don't mess this up. I believe of the dozen of us in the room, only myself, Josiah, who's another Christian Reformed minister, and Raj, who's obviously Sikh, we're the only ones who attend, you know, faithfully attend and participate in religious services. No, that's not true. There's a few others. I can't name names because some of them are very adverse to being on the internet, even though they work in technology, because they work in technology. But, you know, one of the things that one person came, and she had just been to Europe, and she had walked into the Sistine Chapel, and she found herself sort of weeping. And she didn't know why. She wasn't raised Catholic. Her family never went to church, but and then suddenly she had to figure out what just happened to me. And so, and she hadn't really talked about it with hardly anyone, but then when she came to the estuary group, this was what she wanted to talk about. Of course, she said something like this, and the whole group sort of, you know, honed in on it.
And women come and go, talking of Michelangelo.
And another person in the group had, you know, was raised in the church and sort of deconstructed and is kind of in the twilight of it. But, you know, part of where then the conversation sort of, you know, began to turn was how Dante, Virgil, all of this stuff, because
this person talked about the fact that her mother's a little new agey. And so her mother had once told her that in a previous life, she had been a nun. And so I talked about the fact that, you might think your mother's a little batty because of, what she says, but in many ways, all of this stuff is built into us. And it wasn't built into us because someone sat down and built it into us in a very direct, intentional way. But in terms of our first drafts, our cultural first drafts that we have been formed by, when Jim reads that T.S. Eliot piece, it's revelation. It's a moment of clarity where suddenly, even if you didn't realize you were being involved, you were involving yourself with poetry, you don't know anything about T.S. Eliot. You don't even know who painted that ceiling in that Sistine Chapel that is not as big as you imagined it would be. Suddenly you are moved and you weep and you have no idea why. And I reassured her that this is, as a pastor, these are the kinds of things people bring to you because they don't want to tell their family. They don't want people to think they're strange. But I said, this is not uncommon. The spirits of our ancestors mug us sometimes in dark alleys of poetry or art or beauty. And
we can stand things up. We can undermine the possibility of these things having that kind of impact. Yeah. And you can think of the Pietà and you can think, the Protestants are going to look at it as an icon and they're going to say, yeah, that's no good. There's something wrong with that. And the Catholics maybe even are going to look at it as a humanist production out of a personal aggrandizement of Michelangelo's virtuosity. And really what you have there is a woman with her dead child on her lap. And if you cannot emote about that, then, you're really missing something. And if the way we enculturate this stuff is to flatten it, and I would point to the Protestants and their use of the text of the scripture, maybe, and I don't want to be too critical here, but there's some flattening that happens there. And then something like Job, then I see Jess reading Job and coming to tears reading Job. And that is where, that's the meaning for me. That's where it happens. And we need to be able to do that with the whole of it, but with our own Christian faith.
I would just like to point out that even though Father Eric and I are both Catholics, Dr. Jim is not contractually obligated to take hot shots of the Protestant tradition on any time interval. So, it's funny. I sitting down with Jess and talking for a couple hours with Job, it's like So this is one of the things that I love too, right? So Dr. Jim, like, it's Eliot. There's so much Eliot coming out of you. Eliot and Eliot and Eliot. And I know some people in my life are like, Ted's just this like Dante.
Yeah.
And Joe and Jess is this Job
guy.
Yeah. There's this way in which like when you spend enough time with poetry, you don't even have to know who the poet is because we don't, who wrote Job. Maybe Moses. I don't know. Maybe it's oral tradition. Homer's probably oral tradition. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It gets in you, right? And this is why it's like, let's pay attention to what poetry we're listening to, what poetry we're filling ourselves, because it gets in you and it does something to you and then it comes out in another way. And it affords both the possibility for corruption, but on the positive side for tremendous goodness and virtue and the way to get there and the primary virtue of reading poetry is humility. This is just so important, right? It's not being intelligent. Intelligence is not the primary virtue of reading poetry. It's humility, which is why you can have these, simple whoever men who come and become Benedictine monks and they, for many, you know, often in the Middle Ages, some of them wouldn't even know it. I don't even think they were literate, but they would go and they would chant the Psalms over and over and over, and it transformed them. And so all that to say, there's so much about coming to it from the right place. And then when you do that, then it makes you, it actually can make you more than you are. And then Dr. Jim's not just Dr. Jim, but he's also all the riches of Eliot and his struggle and his conquest of the hopeless darkness. And then when I meet Dr. Jim, I'm drawn to that in the same way that I'm drawn to the four quartets. I mean, really, in the same way that I'm drawn to the four quartets. And I don't even have to understand it, because I remember when I got to the end of the four quartets for the first time, I was weeping. And I also thought, I have no idea what I just read. Like, I couldn't have explained it to anyone. Yeah. And if anyone's, you know, if you've read through it, you know what I'm talking about at the end. That metaphor at the end, it just breaks you. It's like, oh. And to this point, there's a gentleman, this is that same summer that I was in La Brie, there's this man named Ellis Potter, who was a Protestant missionary behind the Iron Curtain. Some of you, you're nodding your heads because you know Ellis Potter. This is so weird to me. So I hadn't heard of anything from Ellis Potter since 2014. And then the one Grim Grizz clips compilation that I watch, he's got Ellis Potter on there. And I'm like, I can't handle how all of these things are looping together. But anyway, my first introduction to Ellis Potter was, we sit down at breakfast at La Brie, and it's 7 in the morning and everyone's like totally groggy and trying to be sociable because you have to eat breakfast together. And dang, that's hard for a lot of people. And we launch into Eliot and he starts reciting the Pentecost passage from memory. And he's not a young man at this point, right? He's been through 6-7 decades of life. He's got this thing dead memorized because he can recite it over morning oatmeal. And it moves him like it's the first time he's heard it. And that was actually a really profound experience for me. And so I hope there's some chance that Ellis Potter will hear this, because I remember thinking, I don't know what else I'm going to do, but I want to live my life in such a way that I am that ready to be moved by what is true and beautiful when I'm that age. It's just weird how all this stuff comes together. There's no way I could have planned all, you know, it's like, it's just so weird. So, yeah.
Well, I'm really excited about it. I'm going to have to land the plane here pretty soon, but I'm getting ready, and hopefully it'll be a good experience, and I'm planning on it being a good experience. Yeah.
Is any of this going to be recorded or shared, or for those of us who are not going to get there eventually, or?
We're planning on it. Yeah, we're going to try to record the sort of the main things. Obviously, not any of the discussion, not the discussion groups or anything like that. But yeah, the main in front of the room stuff we'll record and get up online, and and we'll open with paintball if there's enough people interested in paintball, because that's what you do. And so, get on that. Well, Eric, anything else at the end?
Well, you're talking about the importance of humility. Would you like me to end us with a psalm here?
Yes.
Okay. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor haughty are my eyes. I have not gone after things too great, nor marvels beyond me. But truly I have set my soul in peace, like a child at its mother's breast, like a child that is calmed and quieted, even so my soul. O Israel, hope in the Lord, both now and forever. Amen.
Amen.
All righty.
Thank you, gentlemen. I look forward to the next time we talk,
which excellent.
Should be before November, mid-November. And Paul, thanks so much for making space for us.
Yeah, appreciate it, Paul. Thanks.
Absolutely.
All righty. Thank you. All right. God bless you. Bye-bye. All.
Yep. Oh, you're going to end the recording, and then I got to get it from you somehow, Father.
I'll get it. Don't worry about it.
All right, good. I'll probably put it out Monday.
Okay, there you go.
Wonderful.